This is a Saturday Night Live Friday speaker meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous held at Dick's Center in San Jose, California on October 15, 2004. Our 10-minute speaker is Jerry H. Our main speaker is Paco D. of Sunnyvale, California. The original recording of this meeting is kept in the SNL tape library. Please observe the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous and do not play this recording for commercial or entertainment purposes. Please do not break the anonymity of the speakers or any other AA member at the public level. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Jerry, an alcoholic.
Hi, Jerry.
Among other things. And Anthony's taken over my position here as secretary, and I think it's wonderful to see a young guy get involved with AA. And I've been doing this for 4 months now, and it's been one of the highlights of my week. It's really fun. Had a lot of great speakers here, and it's just fun to be involved to this degree. Let's see, I got about 10 minutes, so I'm not going to go through the whole deal. You guys are a little young to hear my story, anyway. Anyway, I was born in Bakersfield in '52, and I'm a California native, and I had my first drunk at 11 years old, and it went from there. I was kind of a jock in school, so I didn't drink again until I was 15 or 16. And then I moved out of my parents' home when I was 17, right here on Winchester and Payne. And I drank every day, or every night. And, I was off to the races, so I drank an awful lot. I went through all the stages it talks about in the book. I had fun with it, and then it was fun with a little bit of problems, and then it was nothing but problems. And, I'm in that book. I'm in that book all over the place. I came to the rooms originally, and I started this sober journey on April 1st of 91. And in Saturday Night Live, and a lot of the faces here, Bud, and a lot of the faces here were here the day I came in here in room 47. And I was beat up enough at that time to stay. You know, I got a lot of relief from not doing what I was doing before, and a lot of my behavior got to change early on. And that's what this whole thing is about, really. Come to find out, it wasn't just the drinking that was a symptom of my problem. The problem is me. So anyway, I went on. At 2 years of sobriety, I moved to Arizona. I had real good sobriety. I was doing what I was needed to do, and I had I was happy, joyous, and free, and built some homes there. And in '97, I decided to come back here. And I moved up to Hayward and Castro Valley. That was my old stomping grounds for a few years. And that's when I fell apart from the program. You know, I was doing some old behaviors, hanging out in my old pubs and hammering Pepsis down. And then it got to where I started carrying some drugs around with me again and dabbling with that for a short time. So from that time to this, I've kind of bobbled or sat on the fence. I got to get 11 months or a year or whatever, and somewhere around 11 years, I decided I was going to drink again. And I can tell you, it's a little progressive. It is progressive. So it's a sleeping lion, because if I could control my drinking and enjoy it, I'd be doing it to this day. And I proved to myself once again that I just go off. I just go nuts. I actually blacked out on in a couple of days of drinking time, and I didn't roll any cars or heard anything. But it told me, it was a wake up call in my brain. So from that time to this, I still bobbled a bit, and my last debauch was about a little over 6 months ago when I was taking Vicodin, and. It says one every 6 hours, but I think I was taking six every 1 hour for a while, and I ran out. And when I ran out, instead of drinking like I would have normally, I wanted to feel that pain, and it turned my brain around 180 degrees, and I said, "What in the fuck are you doing?" So, I came in here crying on a Monday, and I remember James was there. He said, "You need to stay here." What happened? And that's what it took for me. Until I hit the bottom and got to that pitiful, incomprehensible place, I'm not ready to listen. That ego's in the way and all that other stuff. So that's what happened for me just about 6 months ago. And So I decided to really get into this recovery thing because I know it doesn't work the other way. You know, I see it all around me all the time. And the difference for me is I'm working with new guys. I had a secretary position, and I got involved 100%, and it made a big difference for me. I mean, I just live AA, and it's a good feeling. It really feels good, and that's the difference this time around. And I feel real recovery, just like I did when I first got here back in 91, and that's what I was looking for all the time. I actually thought I worried or wondered, would I ever get sober and stay sober again? So those of you who want to go out and research, don't do it. It is not. It's easier to stay here than it is to come back. And it's easier to stay sober than it is to get sober. Man, it's really tough. So I think in my case, I just was sitting on the fence. I was trying the hardest, much as I could. And so I wasn't out there ripping and roaring all the time. But in my own mind, I was just miserable. And if for nothing else, I came in here to have some peace of mind and be comfortable in my own skin. And when I'm doing all the right stuff, it just gives me the feeling of that I'm heading the right direction, you know. So so I did the steps again, the best of my ability, worked with my sponsor, call him every day, and lo and behold, I got some people I'm working with, some sponsors I'm working with, and it's really good for me. It's really good for me. Somebody who's in early recovery, you know, just helps keep me sober. It's as much for me as it is for them, more so for me, I think. And that's the difference now. I never had, even though I had people ask me to sponsor them, they wouldn't call. You know, they would never call. And that happens a lot, too. But my service work used to be in H&I and stuff like that, and I was okay with that. But I know that one-on-one work with another alcoholic is the answer for me and for all of us. You know, it, from day one, that's how it was conceived. You know, Bill and Bob and that picture back there sitting at a hospital bed, one alcoholic talking to the other. It's our common bond. We've all known misery to the nth degree, and that's what really gets us here. And nobody out there is sitting there because they were having a great time, everything was fine, you know, and just ate too many peanuts or something, decided they'd come in and socialize. So there's a good reason for me to be here. And I've been given a lot of gifts, an awful lot of gifts, really, in a short time. It's a joy for me to work with new guys. It makes me grateful. It just makes me really grateful that I'm not doing some of the stuff I see done around me. And, some of my really blatant behaviors were able to change early on. I used to borrow stuff with, you know, before it was officially missing a lot of times, and I justified it in my own mind just like I justified drinking or anything else. And early on in sobriety, well, back in 91, I borrowed something from my brother, and and he noticed it was gone the next day, and I got to work around his house for a couple of months and pay him back. And from that day to this, I haven't stolen anything. That made enough of a change for me. And the other one, the other blatant change that I had a vehicle in Fresno at the time when I first got sober, and it needed some work, and I was going to haul it back here, tow it back, and my uncle called and said, "Jerry, don't bother coming down here. My son and his buddies target practice. They shot it full of holes and ball peen hammered it. And don't bother making a trip down here." And it pissed me off, you know. So I had to get even. And I immediately drove down to Fresno, poured a gallon of gas on my cousin's van and torched it. And I drove away, and there's smoke flying all over there. And my uncle called me, and he said, "Jerry, I don't blame you for torching that van, but Donald never paid me for it." So it was my uncle's vehicle that I had a good rapport with. So I got back here to the rooms, and a friend of mine, a young guy that was in the program, said, "Jerry, you need to read page 449. And that acceptance thing, it hit me like a ton of bricks. And from that day to this, I haven't retaliated. And boy, have I been tested. I've really been tested. I don't even have to go into it. You know, shot at and just a lot of stuff that normally I would react to in a different way. Yeah, recently stolen from, and I covered that today. You know, and stuff like that. So those two blatant changes in me were, really kept me pretty happy most of the time. And then I'm left with all the rest of the stuff that Jerry has to work on. And in steps 6 and 7, you know, I ask God daily to remove some of my shortcomings, and because I can't do it, you know, they're like that, like James says, that thing that keeps popping up, and you whack-a-mole, you pop these things down, and they keep popping up, and that's me with my shortcomings. So, you know, God is my answer, and this book is here to put you in touch with a power greater than yourself, myself, and that's what it's really all about. You know, anybody new here, don't let it scare you. Just stay here and keep coming back. And I was so confused when I got here. I mean, I was so beat up, truly, that I didn't get a whole bunch. But I sat in 3 or 4 meetings a day, and then the lights came on at about a month or so. But anyway, it's all about these character building steps in and of myself, I will break them every single time, as hard as I try. You know, the lying, the cheating, all that stuff keeps popping up. But if I'm aware of it, it doesn't get in. I don't have to make messes out there, and then clean them up afterwards because I try to do the next right thing, and it's only because of the steps and staying really close to what I read in the morning. I read Daily Bread and Daily Word. Almost every day, I have done that for years and don't miss it. And if I take the time to shut this thing down for a minute, because it's like 3 radio stations coming in at one time, and whatever I address first is how my day goes. And you know, for a lot of us, that's true. I mean, I can wake up in the morning and go, oh, you know, and just a million things on my mind. And if I go the negative way, it's not good. But the more I get centered, the more good things happen for me. And right now I got a lot of good things in my life, a lot of blessings. You know, it's like the 8th step. The promises tell us, you know, all these things that are coming true do come true, you know, if you work really hard for them. And this time I've worked really hard, and I just feel like I really belong here, and I'm doing the right stuff, and it's a joy to be in here. I love doing this Friday night speaker meeting. It's been great. I've heard so much good stuff, and it's neat to be connected this way. And it's good to see a young guy take over as secretary and get involved here. That's what it's all about. And we do a lot of fun stuff in this group. You know, this is my home group, Saturday Night Live. I got sober here. They do fun stuff all the time. This Halloween dance coming up and stuff, and it's really a way of life. I think it's there's a million meetings you can go to, but this one is really changed my life. And I guess I can sit down and shut up, but I want to thank all of you for keeping me sober. That's kind of how it works here. Thanks.
How's it going? I'm Paco Dietz. I'm an alcoholic. And my sponsor always tells me, he says, before you chair a meeting, the first thing you need to do is you need to go to the bathroom, get on your knees, and say, God, please remove the script from your head. And I do that pretty well. My mind goes blank at the drop of a hat. So, you know, God works pretty well in my life. I'm really grateful to be asked to speak at a meeting, any meeting, because before I got here, nobody wanted what I had. Even the people who I partied with didn't really want what I had, you know? And, so it's great to be here. It's great to do this. It's not what's natural for me. It's not what's in my nature, you know. What's in my nature is to sit in the back of the room and, you know, try to be as unobserved as possible, which is kind of funny because I'm 6'4" and, you know, I have tattoos all over and, you know, it's kind of hard to blend into the crowd. But you know, that's the way I am. I'm a contradiction, you know. Anyway, it's thanks to my sponsor, thanks to God, thanks to Alcoholics Anonymous and rooms like these and people like you that I've been sober for a little over 14 years. And what I'm going to share with you is some of my experience, strength, and hope, you know, what it was like for me and what it's like today and what's been going on. And what it was like for me was when I, before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, before I ever took that first drink, I had been exposed to alcohol. Well, I had taken a first drink when I was younger because my parents were German and I grew up in a German family, and so if I was sick or whatever, they'd give me a shot of whiskey and the brandy, you know, or brandy and the tea. And when I was 10 years old, my parents were hippies, and so my dad grabbed me and said, "Here, I don't want you to find out about this on the street." So I gave him my first joint. And I had been exposed to drugs and alcohol at an early age. But at 15 years old, something happened for me that hadn't happened to me all those times that I had drank and used, which was that I took a drink and I took a drug and my entire perception changed. I had, at that moment, a spiritual awakening. And the spiritual awakening was that I was going to do this as much as I possibly could for as long as I possibly could. It was a solution that worked. It was better to drink than it was to not drink, you know, and that was the very first thing that I learned. I crossed that invisible line right away, and I made it a conscious decision that I was going to do this as much as I possibly could for as long as I possibly could, and that's exactly what I did. I'm not a half measures kind of guy, you know. I've tried doing the program half measures. I've tried doing things half measures. I'm just not that kind of guy. I'm a full bore all the way, you know, do it till the wheels fall off kind of person. That's exactly the way I am. And anything that works for me, I'm going to do it as much as I possibly can for as long as I possibly can. And that very first time that I got relief, what happened was I said, "I'm doing this as much as I can." You know, and right away I started having fantasies about what it would be like to be, you know, 60 years old with long white hair and smoking pot in a wheelchair, you know. I mean, that was like my big fantasy life right away, you know. I mean, that's what I thought. I thought that's what was going to happen. And I saw nothing at all wrong with it, you know, because, like I said, it gave me a solution that I didn't have. Alcohol and drugs were my solution. Life was unbearable. I was a kid and I was terrified. I was absolutely terrified. I had this huge hole inside of my gut, and I was afraid all the time. I'm overly sensitive, which about a year ago, a woman shared with me. I was chairing a meeting, and I said, you know, I'm a really sensitive alcoholic. And she came up to me after the meeting, and she goes, "You're not sensitive. You're emotionally immature." And I thought, well, yeah, it's the same thing. You know what I mean? If you're sensitive, that's the same thing. It's the same deal. I'm emotionally immature. That's exactly it. And I'm superstitious, and I'm just all these things. And I'm just a mess is what I am. You know what I mean? I'm a walking mess. I'm this, you know, circus show that's going on inside of my head constantly, where, you know, I'm just like a dog on linoleum. I can't quite get a claw on the carpet, you know? And that's the way I am on my own. You know what I mean? That's the way I am without drugs and alcohol. That's just me living life and doing the thing, you know, and walking around and falling apart. That's me, you know, and desperately trying to not let you know that I'm falling apart inside, you know, because that's very important. I learned that was like my first lesson in life, was that no matter how bad you feel or no matter how bad it is, you pretend like it's okay, you know, and you pretend like it's all gravy and you're doing okay, you know, and so that's what I did. And I tried really hard to make it work, and I just knew it wasn't going to work. And I felt like everyone else had some like key to life that I didn't have. And then, you know, I coupled that with having a bad childhood, and my sponsor is fond of telling me that dysfunctional families are like Japanese cars. Everyone's had one, you know. So if you're here and you've had a dysfunctional family, get over it. Do a four-step. Take a look at yourself. It's just a suggestion. Anyway, so I came from this crazy family, and, you know, I was molested when I was six, and I had all this stuff that went on, and you know, I was a mess, and it was all their fault. And so I had all the excuses I needed, and I was off and running, and that's the way it was, you know. And I remember just being, you know, just terrified. You know, I didn't have any idea of who I was or where I was going. I had been to, you know, 30 different schools by the time I was 15. My dad was, I don't know if my dad was an alcoholic or not. I didn't see him for 2 years, and he lived in the same house. He was high on codeine and Valium. So I you make the call. It says we don't like to pronounce anyone alcoholic. I'd say he's probably an alcoholic, but I didn't enjoy saying that. And that was, you know, that was the family that I grew up in, and it was crazy, and it was turmoil. And what I found out coming to Alcoholics Anonymous was that people who had really normal childhoods and really normal families had that same fear and that same delusional, like, lifestyle. I'm one of those people that if I go to see a movie, I come out of the movie 2 hours later, and if it's a good movie, you know, and I come out of the movie 2 hours later, and I'm that person, whoever that person is, you know what I mean? I can go see Young Guns 2, and I come out 2 hours later, and I'm a cowboy, you know what I mean? I go and I see Rocky, and all of a sudden I can fight anyone, you know what I mean? It's just this full flight from reality that I embrace, and it's the same thing everywhere I go. I can watch TV, and if I watch the news, I get really depressed because I figure that stuff's happening to me, you know, and the difference is between that I've come to understand between an alcoholic and a normal person is that normal people have fear and they have stuff that goes on in their head. They just don't believe it all the time. I believe everything that goes on in my head. It's absolutely the truth. If they're thinking about me, I know they're thinking about me. You know, I mean, it's absolutely the truth. And so, you know, I was just terrified, and I was a mess, and I was a wreck, and it was just, it wasn't going well, and it wasn't getting any better. And when I picked up that first drink, and I picked up that first joint, and I did this thing, all of a sudden what happened for me was that I got that sense of peace and ease and comfort. You know, I got relief for the very first time. And so I made a conscious decision that I was going to do this as much as I possibly could for as long as I possibly could. And that's what I did. And I was off to the races, you know. 3 months after I started, I got kicked out of school, you know, and I didn't think that was a problem. You know, school was getting in the way of my drinking. I mean, it's really uncomfortable. You got to go to all these different periods during the day, and, you know, they won't let you just leave to get high to come back, you know, and so I had to sneak out of school to go do that stuff because that was the priority. I wasn't going to school, and I started losing things, but the amazing thing is that no matter how far down I go, I can justify wherever I'm at, you know, after a very short period of time. So my bottom wasn't one thing that happened. It wasn't like I fell off my tricycle and I went, ow, that hurts, you know, I should stop doing this. What happened for me was that I kept going down lower and lower and lower and lower, and it got to a point where I was, you know, I kept hitting these bottoms, and they got harder and harder to accept. They got harder and harder to go, well, everybody goes to jail. Well, everybody gets kicked out of their house. Well, everybody gets kicked out of school. Well, everybody, you know. I mean, it got harder and harder to just roll with that stuff. And that's what it was like for me. It was, you know, I was not a connoisseur. I know there are people that are connoisseurs and they have like these titles, you know, I'm a crack addict, or I'm a, you know, whatever you are, you know. I mean, if you're here, hopefully you're an alcoholic. That's because we have a book for you. You know what I mean? That if you're here and you're something else, we may not be able to help what you have. But if you're here, hopefully you'll catch alcoholism, you know, because I got here and I was a crack addict, and I was, you know, it was way more complex and interesting than an alcoholic. Alcoholics are boring, you know, and I was different. I was young. I was, you know, I was going to make my own way, and, you know, I'm a crack addict. Yeah, because that sounds good, you know. You can just tell that I've been on the firing line of life, you know. You can just tell that the things have been, you know, exciting for me and whatever. And anyway, so... But if you're, you know, if you're a connoisseur, if you're like you had a favorite kind of alcohol or a favorite drug or whatever it was, you know, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not a connoisseur. I'm a garbage can. I take whatever is in front of me. I put it in my body. If it's going to change me for 5 seconds, it's worth it. That's the deal, you know. My whole goal in drinking and using was to not draw a sober breath. That was my entire goal, in a nutshell, was to not draw a sober breath. And I'll tell you why. Because what I discovered in that bottle the very first time was I found relief, and I found the magical elixir of alcohol. What it did for me was it did for me something that I couldn't do for myself. That's why I say I had a spiritual awakening, you know, because I could not do what alcohol did for me without alcohol. And that's the way it was, you know. I was terrified. I had six different voices in my head on any given second. You know, I was running around not knowing what I was doing and not knowing where I was going. And I took this drink and I smoked a joint. And all of a sudden, I got that sense of peace and ease. And the hole kind of filled up a little bit. And I kind of got a little bit of relief. And I thought, well, you know what? I'm going to do this as much as I possibly can. Because what alcohol did for me was it made me look the way you people feel. You know? You may be falling apart. You may be feeling like shit right now. Your life might be just total chaos. But we learn really early on how to like cover that stuff up. And so I walked around and I saw these people and I thought, they all have something I don't have. They're not falling apart. I'm falling apart and they're not. How do I get that? And what happened was when I took a drink, all of a sudden I started to feel the way you look. You know, I started to feel that sense of peace and ease, that sense of comfort, that sense of like wholeness, you know. And so anyway, so that's what it was like for me. And I did it as much as I possibly could for as long as I possibly could. And you know, there's, you know, I have all kinds of little interesting stories. I lived in Compton for 2 weeks and didn't think there was anything wrong with that, you know. I just did all kinds of stuff. Anyway, so what happened for me was that at 20 years old, I got to a point of desperation, and that point of desperation is different for everyone. It says in the big book, incomprehensible demoralization, and incomprehensible demoralization is different for every single person. You know, it's whatever it is that gets your attention. I'll tell you exactly where the bottom is. If you're wondering where the bottom is the point at which you stop and are willing to do something totally foreign to your nature. Because, you know, if I do what's in my nature is to drink and to use. You know, that's what's in my nature. My nature is I'm an alcoholic. My nature is I'm a drug addict. You know, that's what's in my nature. And so at 20 years old, it got bad enough that it got my attention, and I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't come into Alcoholics Anonymous because I was wonderful and I realized that there was a problem. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous because I had burned a bunch of bridges and I was burning one that I was standing on, and I had no other choice, you know. I mean, that's the way it was for me. I had just stolen her pool cue and she was about to come home from work, and I knew that it was going to be bad because I had gotten $20 for it. I had already smoked the crack that I had bought with it, and she was coming home, and it was a $700 pool cue, and there was no way I could pay for it, and I didn't want to own up to it, and so I called Mom, you know, and I said, help. And she said, for the first time, she said, well, are you done? And I said, well, yeah, you know, I'm done. And she goes, well, then maybe we can talk about this, and you can come back home. And I came back home, and the requirement for living at home was to stop drinking and go to meetings. And so I was okay with that. You know, alcohol wasn't my problem, so I stopped drinking. And I started going to meetings, and I hated meetings. I hated Alcoholics Anonymous more than anything else. It was just all full of old people. You guys were like 30, you know, I was 20 years old at that time, and I had seen Logan's Run, and I knew what happened to 30-year-olds, you know what I mean? In an ideal world, you guys were dead at 30, you know what I mean? And that was the deal. And here I am 20 years old, I'm not even legal to drink yet, and I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know? How lame is that? And 5 minutes after I got here, I made a decision that I was going to be the coolest guy in AA. You know, I figured you guys needed a leader, and I was beating my problem now, and I was on top of things, so I was going to be the cool guy in AA, you know. And so I sat in the back row and scowled at everyone and you know, gave that dare you to care look and started fights with people and got in people's faces and did stuff like that. It was just a general pain in the ass in AA. And that's the way it was for me in the beginning. And I kept going out. I kept getting 30 days and going out and getting 30 days and going out and getting 30 days and going out. And I couldn't figure it out, you know. I couldn't figure out why it was that I couldn't get this thing. And the reason I couldn't get this thing was because it was bad the first day. And then the second day it wasn't quite as bad. And then the third day it was a little less bad than it had been. And by the time I got to 30 days, I was thinking of the plan. You know, I had the plan. I was just going to smoke pot socially. probably. As long as I didn't drink and do crack, I'd be okay, you know. And so I did a little social pot smoking, got really paranoid because I had forgotten about that part of it, and went out and got a six-pack, drank the six-pack. As soon as I had the six-pack, I was like, well, shit, it's on. I blew it now anyway, so I might as well go all the way. And you know, I was back and running, and it was the same thing over and over again. And there was this guy, Craig, that went to the meetings where I was going to, and Craig had something that I wanted, and what he had was that he was 25 years old. I weighed 150 pounds. I had burns on my lips and my fingers from smoking crack. I owned one pair of jeans, and Craig was like 25 years old. He had tattoos. I didn't have any tattoos, and I wanted what Craig had. You know, he was half black, half Samoan. He rode a Harley. And I would see this guy at meetings, and I knew it wouldn't be cool to like go up and talk to him. So I just kind of hung out and let him like, you know, sense that I was cool for a while, you know, and so after about, you know, three of these 30 day stints, I saw Craig standing in front of a meeting, and he goes, Paco, come here. And so I walked over to where he was, because the first rule of survival is that if a large person tells you to do something, you do it. You try to look cool while you're doing it, but you do it. And I walked over there and I said, hey, Craig, what's going on? And he goes, hey, you know what? I've been watching you. And he goes, why don't you just drink and get it over with? Because we're all sick of seeing you announce yourself as a newcomer. And I had a spiritual awakening. I had a moment of clarity right there. And my moment of clarity was this. I knew that if I came back to meetings, this very large person was going to kick the shit out of me. And if I didn't go back to meetings, I was going to get kicked out of my house. You know, and I was between a rock and a hard place. And so all of a sudden, I started coming back to meetings and staying sober. I didn't think about the fact that I could just not announce myself as a newcomer. You know what I mean? I never figured that one out. I figured that if I went to meetings, he was going to know I was a newcomer, and he was going to beat me up for being at the meeting. And so that's what I did. And that's the way I stayed sober. If you're here on a court card, or you're here because, you know, you like the coffee and or whatever, if you're here because you want something else from AA, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I didn't get here and stay sober because I was willing or wonderful or grateful or happy or any of that kind of stuff. I got here because I was scared. I'm a chicken shit. I'm a coward. That's my basic nature, is that I'm a total coward. And so one more time, one of my character defects actually worked in my favor. And so I started going to meetings and staying sober. And at the end of my first year of sobriety, I got up in front of a meeting and got my 1 year chip, and I said, you know, thanks a lot and screw you anyway, you know, and I said, I did it in spite of you. Because at that point, people had started talking about me behind my back. They were thinking about me behind my back. I'd come into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and people would get up and leave. And I don't know why. I mean, I was kicking over tables and chairs and getting in people's faces and causing drama and doing all this stuff and doing just whatever. And people would get up and leave. And as I'm walking down the aisle from getting my 1 year chip, everyone said, keep coming back, you know, and that's the way my first year of sobriety was. You know, I stayed sober that first year on resentments, and that was it, you know. I was just pissed off enough at all of you to not want to prove you right that I was going to go back out and drink. And you guys said all this stupid shit. I would listen to this crap that people would talk about. Somebody came up to me in my first 30 days and goes, hey, you know, you got a tail. What are you talking about? What are you talking about? I've got a tail. He's like, yeah, you got a tail. You can't see it, but you got a tail, and everyone else can see it, and you're dragging it behind you, and you got this tail. And I was like, what the hell are you talking about? You know what I mean? And there was all this cutesy shit about turn it over and let it go and live and let live, and we're going to love you till you can love yourself. And, you know, I mean, it was just all this stuff. And I was like, and you know what I remember from the very first meetings that I went to? I don't remember, like, how it works or 12 traditions or, you know, work with others or work the steps or any of that kind of stuff. What I remember was that there used to be this sign in the fellowship where I got sober. And somebody had decided to nail up this sign which said, please don't use profanity in AA. And half the room said, yeah, we shouldn't exhibit barroom behavior and we should, you know, clean up our act. And the other side of the room was like, fuck you. You know, we'll say whatever we want to say. We don't give a shit. This is Alcoholics Anonymous. We can talk any way we want. And that's all I remember. Like, that's all I remember from the first meetings. All I remember was that controversy going on, you know. But And but the deal is that, you know, I didn't want what you people had, but I wanted what I had just a little bit less. You know, I wanted what I had just a little bit less. And if you're in Alcoholics Anonymous, if you're here tonight and you don't really want what we have, but you want what you have just a little bit less, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. Welcome to AA. It's the best deal in town when it's the last deal in town. That's what my sponsor says over and over again, and I absolutely believe it. You know, it's absolutely the best deal in town when it's the last deal in town. And unfortunately, it took me another 5 years to work that first step. And what that first step is, you know, we have an amazing workshop program here for the first step. It's really good. You can do it a couple different ways. But the first step workshop is basically this. It's going on in bars. It's going on in crack houses. And it's going on in these rooms where you're falling apart and you're staying sober and you're white-knuckling it, you know. And hopefully you'll get to a point of desperation. Hopefully you'll get to that point, because that's exactly what happened to me. At 5 years sober, I had sponsors. I had done the bare minimum of what sobriety was asked of me. You know, I had gotten sponsors, and I had not drank, and I had not drank in between the meetings, and I was just a mess. You know, because I labored under this delusion that somehow, if I stayed sober, everything would be okay. You know, I thought that if I just stayed sober, everything would be all right. All I need to do is just not drink no matter what. And that's what I really thought the solution was. And I had forgotten that I was totally and completely sober when I decided to pick up that first drink at 15 years old and get that relief. You know, I was in a state of sobriety at that point, you know, and my life was so bad that I had to have a drink to get a solution, to get something that worked for my problem, you know. And so I thought that I thought all I had to do was stay here and stay sober and I'd be okay. And it didn't work for me. At the end of 5 years of that, I was ready to blow my brains out. I was just absolutely miserable. I got really depressed. And by the way, if you're depressed and you're here, thank God for the depression. It's a wonderful thing. If you're depressed, and because with any luck, if you stay depressed long enough, you'll hit despair. And if you're in despair for long enough, then you'll hit desperation. And desperation is the only thing that I've found that makes me want to work the steps. I don't want to work the steps because I woke up one morning and said, you know, geez, it would be really nice to have a God of my understanding in my life today. You know, wouldn't it be nice if I just decided to go to church today, you know, or whatever. I didn't wake up and suddenly become wonderful. You know, what happened for me was that I got desperate enough to accept with eagerness what you people had to offer. That's what happened to me. It was because I had nowhere else to go. And at the end of 5 years, what had happened to me was that I was absolutely out of ideas. You know, I had no ideas left whatsoever. I had tried everything I could possibly think of to try to change my life and try to fix me, and none of it had ever worked. None of it had worked at all. And, you know, I tried the financial solution. I tried to be a better boyfriend, to have a better girlfriend, to try to, you know, getting a better job, and doing all these different things, and none of those things had ever fixed me. You know, it didn't matter what it was, none of those things had fixed me. And I got to that, you know, Chuck C. talks about it in A New Pair of Glasses. He says, the best we can hope for is to be good for nothing. And it was at the end of 5 years of that I became good for nothing. You know, I absolutely became good for nothing. And I didn't understand what that meant for the longest time. You know, the best that I can hope for is to be good for nothing. That doesn't make any sense. That's not what my parents taught me. That's not what society has told me. That's not what anybody's ever said to me. Nobody ever said, give up. You know, nobody ever said, surrender, stop fighting. Nobody ever said that to me. They said, keep going, keep your chin up, keep, you know, and that's what they said. And so good for nothing made no sense to me. And I was sitting in a meeting a couple of years ago, and that what he said was going over and over again in my head. And what I came to realize, what I suddenly understood, was that, oh, yeah, if I'm good for something, then that's something I don't need God's help with. I don't need God's help. Why would I need God's help? If I'm good at making money, I don't need God's help to make money. I'm not gonna turn that over to God. You know, if I'm pretty good at getting laid, I'm not gonna turn to God for sex. You know, I mean, I'm good at it. I'm good. You know, I'm it's all right. It's not a problem. I got it handled. You know, I mean, if it's anything that I'm good at, then there's something. I don't need God's help. I don't need God's help for that thing. And so what happened for me was at the end of 5 years of staying sober and going to meetings and having sponsors and not drinking, I got desperate enough to be good for nothing. You know, I gave up. I surrendered. And I heard somebody say once the definition of surrender is, you know, when you surrender, what you do is you put down your weapon, you sit on the side of the road, and you wait for somebody else to tell you what to do. And I got to that point. You know, I got to that point of I just given up. I had nothing left. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous hadn't worked, and nothing else had worked, and I was alone, and I was terrified, and my life was a mess, and I was falling apart. And it was at that point that I hit desperation. I was willing to do whatever it took. You know, but it wasn't until that point that I was actually willing to do that first step. And you know, whatever it takes for you to get done. I'm not going to be the guy who says, you know, just don't drink no matter what. You know what? If you're not convinced you're an alcoholic, go drink. Go figure it out. You know? Don't sit around in the meetings and not know. I mean, know that you're an alcoholic. It only seems to work with us when we're alcoholics. For example, let me just give you a good example here. I was on a 12-step call. I didn't mean to be, but I was on a 12-step call a little while ago. I was over at Starbucks, and I'm doing my normal thing and buying coffee, you know, and which is something I learned in AA. And I'm over there, and this woman comes up behind me, and she goes, "You're Paco, aren't you?" And I go, "Yeah." And she goes, "Oh, do you remember me?" And I said, "No." And she goes, "Well, I've seen you around the meetings." And I go, "Hey, how's it going?" And she's like, "It's not going so good. I'm drunk." And I said, "Oh, yeah? You want to talk about it?" And she goes, "Well," she mumbled something at me, and I don't remember what she said. But and then she walked out front and sat down. So I got my coffee, and I walked out front, and I sat down next to her. And for 15 minutes, this is what she said. She said, "I can't believe it's you. Everybody hates you. Nobody likes you. Everyone in AA can't stand you." And for 15 minutes, I listen to this, right? And I go, "Well, then God must think it's really bad if he sent me to save your dumbasses." I mean, that's kind of the deal, you know? If you want what we have, it's got to be bad enough for you not to want what you have. You know, that's the deal. It's got to be that bad that you'd go, "Wow, Paco looks like a good option." I mean, that's got to be bad. You know, that's got to be bad. And those are the people, you know, if you're in that state, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the best deal in town. Because if you get to that point, we might just have a solution for you. I got a call from central office here in Santa Clara, and they said, "We got this guy who's drunk. Will you give him a call?" And I said, "Yes." And I called him up and I'm talking to him for about 5 minutes and I go, "So do you want somebody to come out and talk to you?" The very first thing he says when I'm offering to go on a 12-step call for this guy is he goes, "How much time do you have?" And I said, "If you're interviewing the guy who's coming to save your life, then you may not be done yet." You know, if you're looking for resumes for the guy who's come, I mean, you're so messed up that you've decided to call Alcoholics Anonymous. That's bad, right? And then you've gotten a drunk on the other end of the line, and then you're trying to figure out if he's got the right credentials. You know what I mean? To handle my case. I don't know. Maybe you'll get sober that way. It didn't work that way for me. You know, I had to be done. I had to be desperate. I had to be willing to do whatever it took, and I had to be willing to accept it from anyone who was willing to give it to me. And that's exactly the way it had to be for me. At the end of 5 years of just staying sober and choosing the sponsors that I had and doing all that stuff, that's exactly what happened. I got to that point of desperation, and I was willing to do whatever it took. And the sponsor that I got shortly thereafter was not the sponsor that I wanted. What the sponsor that I wanted was the sponsor who was going to love me till I could love myself. The sponsor I wanted was the one who was going to loan me money. I liked those sponsors. The sponsor that I wanted was the one who was going to let me sleep on his couch and possibly sleep with his wife and, you know, get away with anything that I could. The sponsor who was willing to listen to me. Because, see, I'm an alcoholic. And if you listen to me for too long, you'll get sick with me. You know, if you start nodding your head at my sob story and going, oh, I've got you. You know, I can do whatever I want to you because I'm a poor, sick kid and I don't really know what I'm doing. And, you know, golly shucks, you know, it's just the way it goes. Right. And so I used and abused these sponsors that I had before that. And so I called up this man and he always says for me to say his full name when I get recorded. I got Ben Wilson to sponsor me and he was kind of arrogant and I didn't like the way he talked to me and he wasn't very sensitive at all, you know, and I'm a sensitive guy. I've told you that, right? I'm really sensitive. I need somebody to nurture me. I need somebody to figure out where my inner child is and just love it, you know. That's what I need. And I called this guy up and he, you know, and I said, Ben, will you sponsor me? And he said, yeah. And I said, when do you want to get together? Right? Cause that was always my first requirement for sponsorship. You're going to buy me a meal at Denny's, right? And we're going to sit down and we're going to talk and we're going to have this little like chit chat and you're going to listen to my story and you're going to get sick because you're going to start nodding your head and identifying with me. And then I've got you. And he said, I don't want to get together with you. And I said, okay. And I said, well, what do you want me to do? And he said, I want you to work on that four-step and hung up the phone on me. Not very sensitive, you know? Not compassionate. I mean, I'm sensitive. I could drink over that. You know what I mean? I could drink over that. But the thing was that I was done. I was done. And so him hanging up on me wasn't that big of a deal. You know, what it left me with was it left me with two options. Either I find another sponsor and find somebody who's going to, you know, continue to give me the stuff that I've been getting, or I'm going to do what he tells me to do and I'm going to call him back. And so, you know, about 2 weeks went by and I was balking on my four step and I had finished about halfway through it and I called him up and I said, Ben, you know, I'm in a lot of pain. What do I do? And he said, I want you to go out and get three sponsees. And I said, I can't do that. You know, I haven't graduated. I don't have my diploma. I don't have my card. I don't even sound good in meetings yet. You know what I mean? I can't do this thing. And he goes, here's the deal. He said, you're a hypocrite. And the worst thing for a hypocrite is to be found out. You're going to get three sponsees. You're not going to want these guys to know you don't know what the hell you're talking about. And so you're going to start working the steps in the manner that it talks about in the big book, which is what it says. It says, next we launched out in a course of vigorous action. It doesn't say next we launched out in a course of vigorous thinking, or next we dabbled a little bit into the steps, or it doesn't say we talked to our counselor first before we moved on. It doesn't say anything like that. It says next we launched out on a course of vigorous action. And that's exactly what happened. I got these three sponsees. I worked the first three steps of them right away because that's what he told me to do. He said if you're in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, you work steps one and two. Otherwise, what the hell are you doing here? You know, if you haven't worked step one, why the hell would you admit to being an alcoholic? You know, if you haven't done step one, why would you come here? I already talked about how you'd have to be desperate to want what we have. I think the funniest tradition is the one that says it's it's not promotion, you know, it's attraction rather than promotion. Who the hell would be attracted to this? I don't know about you, but Friday night I have other things to do. You know what I mean? I wouldn't be attracted to this until there was nothing left. If I had something left, I would not be attracted to this. And so I worked the first three steps with these guys. Two of them disappeared. They vanished. They were gone, you know. And they just took off. And then the third guy was from hell. And he was calling me every single day going, hey, sponsor, what do we do now? Hey, sponsor, what's next? Hey, sponsor, you know, and I'm going, hang on. I'll call you back in 5 minutes. And I'd call my sponsor. I'd write on my four step. I'd call my sponsor back and I'd say, okay, what's the next part? You know what I mean? Because I was having to, like, keep ahead of this guy. And my sponsor said, that's great, you got three sponsees, now go out and get three more. Fuck, man, this guy's, you know. And I'm looking around the meetings and I'm going, I don't see anybody else's sponsor telling them to do this. I mean, what the hell? Other people's sponsors are telling them to go to 90 meetings in 90 days. Other people's sponsors are telling them to be a coffee maker. Other people's sponsors are telling them to do all this other stuff. And my sponsor knew I was too stupid to figure any of that stuff out. If I had been a coffee maker, if he told me to be a coffee maker, I would have figured that was a spiritual solution and my life would be fixed. What he told me was he told me to go out there and get these sponsees. Excuse me. And And so I went out and got another three sponsees. I called him up. I said, I got six sponsees. He said, if you can count the number of sponsees you don't have enough because you're managing them. And all of a sudden, what happened for me was that I got to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't plan on it. I didn't know it. I wasn't ready. I wasn't good enough. You know, I wasn't any of that stuff. I didn't think I had anything to offer. And my sponsor always told me, he said, you know what? You don't have anything to offer until you offer it. And you won't have anything to offer until you offer it. But you got to get off your fat, lazy ass and go offer it, and then it'll be there for you to give away. And so I started sponsoring a lot of people. And I'm full of shit. I'm a total hypocrite. Total hypocrite. Total, complete hypocrite. If you're not a hypocrite, check into it. It's a good thing to be. It's a good thing to be a hypocrite. Because all of a sudden I started telling these guys, hey, you should be a coffee maker. You know? I started telling them, go secretary a meeting. Hey, you should go do this. And hey, go do that. And you know what? I can't tell you to do something and relax and not do it. You know, if I start talking about sponsorship and 12-step calls and, you know, doing all this stuff and going and doing these things and starting meetings and stuff like that, it's really uncomfortable for me not to do them. It's really, really uncomfortable for me not to do them. And so I started telling these guys all this stuff, and all of a sudden I had to go out there and I had to start doing this. And just try this as a little experiment. Get a sponsee, find out if he's got warrants. If he's got warrants, tell him to go turn himself in on the warrants. And if you have warrants, it'll be impossible for you not to turn yourself in. I guarantee it. I guarantee it. It's impossible. It's impossible to tell somebody else to stand on the front line of life, the firing line of life, and then not do it yourself. And that's exactly what happened for me. And once again, one of my baser character defects got used to save my ass, you know. And that's what happened for me. I started doing a lot of work in Alcoholics Anonymous as a result of the desperation that I was in. I didn't start doing a lot of work in Alcoholics Anonymous because I was wonderful. You know, I didn't do it because I was ready to do it. I did it because I was desperate enough to do whatever it took. That was the deal, you know. And so as a result of that, I've gotten to do some really amazing things in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've gotten to go on 12-step calls. I've gotten to, you know, I started the diverter service in San Mateo, you know, 3 years ago or whatever, being prompted by my sponsor. I've gotten to do a lot of things in Alcoholics Anonymous that are just amazing. They're beyond my imagination. And I've had things happen to me that are just mind-blowing. And, you know, but it wasn't because I sat around the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous getting ready to do this thing. I was sitting next to a newcomer, I don't know, it was probably about a year and a half ago or so. And the speaker called on her and said, would you like to stand up and share? And she said, I don't have anything to share. And I said, if you don't stand up, you never will. You know, that's the deal. If you want to know how Alcoholics Anonymous happens and how it works, then you've got to go out there and make it work and make it happen. You know, the reason that so many people stayed sober in the beginning of Alcoholics Anonymous was because there was nobody else to pass the responsibility on to. Either you did it or there was no meeting. That was the way it worked, you know. Either you did it or there was no 12-step call happening, you know. Either you did it or that guy was going to stay in the gutter and was going to die in the gutter. You know, there was nobody to go, oh, well, he'll get it, you know. Oh, well, they'll do it. Oh, well, it'll get done. You know, you guys have a diverter service. There's spots available on the diverter service. If you haven't been involved in teleservice, I highly recommend teleservice as something that will improve your sobriety greatly. You know, get a 4-hour shift or whatever it is around here, a 6-hour shift or whatever, and invite some of your sponsees over to answer the telephones for Alcoholics Anonymous. Go on 12-step calls with these guys. It's an amazing thing. It's absolutely amazing. Because what happens is that I come to Alcoholics Anonymous and I get to learn what it's like to be sober. You know, I get to learn what it's like to deal with situations and issues that happen when you're sober. And I hear about that all the time. You know, well, what do I do if I lose my job? Well, what do I do if she walks away? Well, what do I do if this happens? What do I do if that happens? When I go on a 12-step call and I work with a wet drunk, what I learn is the reason that I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous. The reason that I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous is so that I don't have to lie in that gutter one more day. You know, the reason I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous is so I don't have to be that guy. You know, and that's as simple as it is. What's been going on recently for me is this past week has just been absolutely crazy. You know, it's just been just like a whole series of drama. I got a call, well, actually I got an email from my mom saying there was something wrong with my daughter, And she didn't know what it was, and she was trying to figure it out. And a couple of days later, I got an email from, you know, from her, and I talked to her and all this kind of stuff. Well, it turns out that what happened was that my 13-year-old daughter decided that 13 was a good age to have sex. And then a couple of days later, what I found out was that her mom had put her in the same bed with her cousin, who's 14 years old, and so they had had sex under her roof. And then I found, you know, and just all this stuff. And it's just been like this nonstop stream of stuff that's been going on. And, you know, and I've been talking to my sponsor a lot and doing what I was suggested to do. And he told me the other day that I needed to call Child Protective Services, which scares the hell out of me, you know. It scares the hell out of me because I don't, you know, I mean, it's... I've done my four step. I've done this stuff, and I've taken a look at myself, and I know that I'm nobody to cast the first stone. You know what I mean? I'm nobody to cast the first stone. And but he said, you know what? It's not about you. It's about your daughter, and her life's in danger. If she's in a situation where the person that she's living with is telling her it's okay to do these things, then you need to do something about it. And so I grudgingly did it, you know, and all this stuff, you know, all the stuff that I do is, you know, like wearing a suit. I don't want to wear a suit to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. I don't even like showing up a lot of the times. I don't want to do any of this stuff, you know, but the truth is very basic, and it's like this. I used to do exactly what I wanted to do whenever I wanted to do it. If you had something, I took it. If you, you know, whatever it was, I did what I wanted to do, and I was out there ripping and running. You know, I used to say that life sucked all the time, and life didn't suck. I sucked life. If I knew you at all for 5 minutes, I would suck some little part of your life out of you, you know? I would figure out how to get your money or how to get your woman or how to, you know what I mean? I would take something from you. And what I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and that was me doing exactly what I wanted to do. And as a result of doing exactly what I wanted to do, I didn't ever get to feel the way I wanted to feel. And today I do things that I absolutely don't want to do, and I get to feel the way I've always wanted to feel. You know, what an amazing thing that is. None of this stuff is in my nature, which is something that I come across with sponsees all the time. I'm always getting that from sponsees. Oh, it's not in my nature. It's not in my nature. And I would say, good. If it was in your nature, then you'd be drunk. You know? I mean, what's in my nature is to drink and to use on a relentless basis. What's in my nature is not to stand up at a meeting and talk to you people. You know? What's in my nature is not to come to a meeting. What's in my nature is not to be of service to my fellow man. You know? What's in my nature is not to pay back all the money I owe. Screw that. You know, I'm not doing that. What's in my nature is not to do any of these things. And I have to do stuff that's against my nature so that I can stay sober. And that's what I've been doing for, you know, 14 years is doing stuff that's against my nature. And, you know, it's such an amazing life. I got to share with you a 12-step story real quick. I went to this 12-step call with one of my sponsees. I've been on a lot of 12-step calls. I really think it's a really important thing to do in sobriety. If you haven't worked with a wet drunk, you need to check it out. It's really good stuff. What happens is, if you start working with a wet drunk, working with others takes on a whole different meaning. You know, if I read working with others and then I go, well, but these guys don't look like this guy, I have to go and work with the wet drunk to figure out that that's who they're talking about. That in working with others, they're talking about that 12-step call. They're talking about going on that call. And I went on this 12-step call with one of my sponsees. And the thing that was unique about this 12-step call was that it was in a mansion. And so I'm standing in front of this mansion, and I'm looking at my sponsee, and I'm going, this is not the right place, you know? I mean, this is not the place where there's an alcoholic living. I mean, it was a huge place, and it just wasn't right. And we went up to the front door, and we knocked on the door, and this beautiful woman answered the door, and I said, we're here from Alcoholics Anonymous. Do you, you know, have somebody that needs help? And she goes, oh, yeah. And she pointed to the couch. And here's this shriveled up little guy who looks like he just got beamed in from another alternate alcoholic dimension, you know, because he's in his underwear and he's got the tumbler full of, you know, whatever, some magical elixir that he's found, you know. I mean, whatever the brand name is that was in the plastic, you know, tumbler, the Kool-Aid jar. And he's sitting there, he's laying on the couch, and he's got scratches all over his face and all over his arms, and apparently he just fell down the stairs yesterday, and, you know, and I'm going, wow, this guy does not fit in this picture at all. I mean, here's this mansion, here's this beautiful woman, here's the alcoholic, you know? And so we ended up talking to this guy for a little while, and he offered to hire one of us as a sponsor. It was tempting. I was broke at the time. But I said, no, we do this thing for fun and for free. And, you know, I said, are you willing to go to a meeting? And he goes, no, I'm really not. I just don't feel comfortable in those meetings. And I really just don't feel like Alcoholics Anonymous is for me. And I go, oh, yeah, well, what's the plan? Well, what are you going to do? I mean, you called us. So what's the plan? I mean, why are you drunk now? You know? And he goes, well, my psychiatrist lives with me. And because I guess the psychiatrist bought the sponsorship paying package, you know. And but he was living so well off of this guy that he decided he was going to go to Hawaii for his vacation. And while on vacation, the guy got drunk because he didn't have his live-in babysitter to sit with him and hold his hand and make sure that he didn't drink. And I said, okay, so you're going to wait for your psychiatrist to come back, and then what's going to happen? And he goes, oh, well, we've already figured it all out. And I was all ears. I'm dying to hear this plan because I know this is going to be a good plan. You know what I mean? This is going to be a doozy. And so I sit back and I go, okay. And he goes, well, check it out. I said, my psychiatrist has already signed me up. And what it is there's this rehab in somewhere in Carolina or someplace like that. And basically, what they do in the rehab is they take you there and they have this African root that they feed you and you hallucinate for 14 days and then you're no longer an alcoholic. I had no response to that. I mean, how do you fight with that plan? That is a perfect plan. If I was a newcomer and I had the means, I'd be signed up for the next 6.5 months. You know what I mean? That just sounds like a great plan to me. And I said, well, you know, hey, you know, that's awesome. I don't know what to say. I guess you're all set. Well, here's my number. I'll see you later, you know. And I turned around and I walked out of this person's house and we got into the street and we had been 12-stepping him in his theater surround theater system room where he had like this projector from NASA. I mean, this guy was really well off. And my sponsor, he turns to me and he goes, would you trade what you have for what this guy has? And I said, not in a million years. I said, this guy's so rich that he's going to die drunk. He's so well off that he's going to die drunk. And that's what I've come to understand. If you're too pretty for Alcoholics Anonymous, you may have to die drunk. If you're too well off for Alcoholics Anonymous, you may have to die drunk. If you've got too much stuff going on, you may have to die drunk. See, the people that really seem to make it here are the people who have been beat up bad enough that they want what we have. But if you're not really sure or you're on the fence or whatever, I'm not going to be the guy to say, don't drink. You know, if you're not sure, maybe you need to get a little uglier. You know, maybe you need to get a little bit more broke. Maybe you need to lose a little bit more stuff. And hopefully you'll get relief in Alcoholics Anonymous, because this is absolutely what I've found that works. It's the only solution that I've ever found that works. I've tried religions. I've tried counselors. I've tried therapists. I've been the gamut. You know, I've tried reading better books, and I've tried doing all kinds of stuff like that. Everything that it talks about on that page where it says taking physical exercise, not taking a trip, all those kind of things. I've tried all that stuff because Alcoholics Anonymous is where I came last. You know, I didn't come here first. I had to come here last. I went out of this 12-step call with this other guy one time, and this woman was there, and she was the codependent, and he was the alcoholic, and I said, so what's going on? And she goes, well, the first thing we did was we called Chick Shadell because, you know, he'd been through the program there, and we wanted to find out if there was something to do about his relapse, and they said, no, he's a real alcoholic. We can't help him. And so then she'd called the police because he had gotten belligerent. And then she'd called Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, that's the list. You call the treatment center, you call the police, you call AA. You know what I mean? We're not the first place you call. You only call this place when you're done. You know, and that's why teleservice is such a great thing. Because if you're doing teleservice, then you might just be the person who gets that call when it's the last thing on the list. You know, the last hope, last house on the block. And it's as a result of this thing being the last house on the block and the best deal in town that I've gotten to stay sober and have a really good life, you know, in spite of myself. And I haven't gotten wonderful in AA. I'm not perfect. I'm not that guy. You know, it says twisted thinking and depression will not vanish in a twinkling. My sponsor's got 33 years of sobriety, and he says a twinkling must be longer than 33 years because it hasn't happened for him either yet, you know, and I need to know that. I need to know that I'm not here to become perfect or wonderful. What I'm here to do is, no matter what goes on in my life, that I can stay sober through it, you know. And my sponsor made that clear to me over and over and over again. What he said to me over and over and over again, I'd call him up and I'd bitch and I'd moan and I'd complain about whatever was going on with me. And he'd tell me over and over and over again, he'd say, this may be as good as your sobriety ever gets, and it had better be good enough. And that's the truth, you know. The end result of working these steps and working with others and doing things that are uncomfortable and doing all this kind of stuff is that I get to stay sober. I get a lot of other fringe benefits, you know, but I didn't go out looking for those things. All that happened for me was that I was desperate enough to do whatever it took, and as a result of that, my life got amazing, you know. And so I'm eternally grateful to Alcoholics Anonymous for the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that I was shown the way to do this thing out of the big book. You know, if you want what we have, do what we do. And it's outlined in the first 164 pages. This is another really good suggestion for you. If you're having troubles reading the big book, I would suggest getting a dictionary. Really. It's really a good thing. The big book of Alcoholics Anonymous is called our basic text. Look up the word basic and text. It's really enlightening. Basic means vital and necessary. Text means something to be studied and followed. And from knowing that, I know that this thing is a blueprint for my life that can work for me in rough going and in good going and whatever else, you know. This thing is absolutely something that can save my butt, and it does on a regular basis, you know. And like I said, I haven't gotten wonderful. I haven't gotten perfect, you know. I'm still just flawed. You know, thank God I'm not 14 years sober and I can stand up here and go, life is just better and better and better and better and better. You know what? Life is just life. Life is what life is. And I can equally not enjoy the good times in my sobriety as not enjoying the bad times in my sobriety. Because if I don't do this stuff, then I don't seem to be able to enjoy the good times either. You know, but if I do this stuff, then I get to enjoy the good times, I get to enjoy the bad times, I get to have a life that's beyond my wildest dreams, I get to be rocketed into the fourth dimension of existence of which I had not even dreamed. And if you haven't had that experience yet, go get some sponsees, work with some wet drunks, sign up for teleservice, do this thing. Thanks a lot.